I'd like to invite our speaker, Tom Botsford, up. He is a longtime member of this church and a fairly recently retired English professor.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Aaron and Bobby. And Aaron is going to help me. We will begin with some readings, and then we'll unpack the readings. I'm going to do the first one. This is from Song of Myself. I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. Loaf with me on the grass. Loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best, only the lull I like, the hum of your valved voice. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me, and parted the shirt from my bosom bone, and plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart, and reached till you felt my beard, and reached till you held my feet. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth. And I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own. And I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own. And that all the men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers. And that a kelson of the creation is love. And limitless are leaves stiff or drooping in fields, and brown ants in the little wells beneath them, and mossy scabs of the worm fence, heaped stones, elder, murlaine, and pokeweed. Here's your second one.
28 young men bathe by the shore. 28 young men and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides, handsome and richly dressed, aft the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs. Their white bellies bulge to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray.
That's also from the same poem, Song of Myself. Lots of different kinds of writing in Song of Myself. Here's your third reading, Proud to Be the Tenderest Lover. Now, this one is from the new, in quotes, new book by Whitman, which we'll be talking about, Live Oak with Moss. It's not really new, of course. More on that later. But this comes from this book, and it's not so well known. Proud to be the tenderest lover. Come, I will inform you who I was underneath that impassive exterior. I will tell you what to say of me. Publish my name and hang up my picture as that of the tenderest lover. The friend, the lover's portrait of whom his friend, his lover, was fondest. Who was not proud of his songs, that is, his poems, but of the measureless ocean of love within him and freely poured it forth, who often walked lonesome walks thinking of his dearest friends, his lovers, who, pensive away from one he loved, often lay sleepless and dissatisfied at night, who, dreading lest the one he loved might after all be indifferent to him, felt the sick feeling, oh, sick, sick, whose happiest days were those far away through fields and woods on hills, he and another, wandering hand in hand, they twain, apart from other men. We are celebrating Walt Whitman's 200th birthday this year, If you've read Leaves of Grass and encountered poetry like this, not just this kind, but much else. This is just a very small sampling. There are many leaves in the Leaves of Grass, as you can see. But if you've read any of it, you might find yourself thinking, as I do, that Whitman was a Unitarian Universalist in all but name. After all, he celebrated the inherent worth and dignity of every person long before anyone talked about diversity. And you just heard Aaron read, "This is the meal equally set. This the meat for natural hunger. I will not have anybody. I'll even take the venereal Lee." Never had seen that word before. You can guess what it means. But he celebrated the inherent worth and dignity of every person. He believed in spiritual and political equality to a degree almost unheard of in his day. He advanced a sweeping optimistic vision. I tell students, enjoy Whitman's optimism, because once you get past Whitman, it seems to get darker and darker and darker. Yeah, he believed in equality to a degree almost unheard of in his day. He advanced this sweeping optimistic vision that seeks to overcome all fear, especially the fear of death, and to affirm life as good beyond measure, a miracle. Whitman was a great patriotic poet. He celebrated the nation and its heroes, including most notably President Lincoln after his assassination, and maybe many of you have read the utterly gorgeous When Lilacs Last in Dooryards Bloom. During the Civil War, he was a nurse in Washington, D.C., tending to hundreds of wounded soldiers and helping some of them write letters home. They've uncovered those. Most significantly for us, Whitman revolutionized writing, American literature, because he used distinctive, grand, but casual, earthy language, including slang and all kinds of regionalisms, to create a new voice for poetry, one that could only come from the United States. And he regarded the United States as a poem in themselves. In fact, until Whitman and Mark Twain came along, you might say that even the best American literature was an imitation and elaboration of European forms, as good as Edgar Allan Poe was, Nathaniel Hawthorne. And Emerson loved Whitman. Emerson wrote Whitman a note, "I greet you at the beginning of a great career." And boy, did Whitman use that. He used that to promote his work. Emerson said, "I would hold back some on the sax part." He wasn't going to do that. But it was Whitman, not Emerson. Emerson was a great intellectual and thinker, but it was Whitman who created the new voice in poetry. And along with Emily Dickinson, I don't know if any better in the 19th century and maybe the 20th. But that's something about the importance of Walt Whitman. But our title today has the diction "gay icon" as well as "American visionary." But how could Whitman be a gay icon in a time when there was no acceptable name for homosexuality? Indeed, the word homosexual was not in use at the time. So before we answer the question, let's unpack the poetry that Aaron and I read aloud. Body and soul. The I in this passage is Whitman's body, and the body is in conversation with the soul. He says he values both. But what in the world is going on in the second stanza? To almost everybody who's read this, this is a homoerotic scene. How could it be anything else between the body and the soul? And as a result of that, look what happens. He has, in the third stanza, cosmic consciousness as a result of the union of the body and soul, which he uses, and he uses a sexual metaphor for that. You have a spiritual awareness. He refers to the peace and knowledge that pass the argument of the earth, the peace that passes all understanding. That's what everybody wants. They want to live in this state of mind in the third stanza. Well, a kelson of the creation is love, and everybody's your brother and sister, and you feel perfectly accepted, and everything is fine. Did you notice that when you heard it the first time? Now, this next one is in the same poem, Song of Myself, but how different. It's a scene, an imagined scene. It really is a sexual fantasy, and it comes as a surprise as you read the work. Right before that, it's discussing runaway slaves and helping a runaway slave, and all of a sudden, you have this scene told from the point of view of a woman who is a voyeur, no less, who imagines herself sexually frolicking with 28 young men bathing in a lake or a river. Did you notice that? Her, in quotes, unseen hand passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. And in so many words, she imagines, well, you can read the last stanza. The reference here is to more than water. You can kind of piece it all together. Well, when people did piece that together, and many didn't, they were offended, along with other there were other passages, too, and much of his early poetry that offended many critics. And in their 19th century point of view, they found him, of course, to be indecent and vulgar. What respectable woman would think something like this, they would say? What respectable anybody would think something like this? Was it Whittier that threw his copy in the fire? And Thoreau admired him, but the sex stuff freaked him out. Of course, you know, the ladies up in Cambridge said they'd rather take the bough of a willow than the hand of Henry David Thoreau. That was the gossip anyway, so. it was controversial, this part of him. This last poem, Proud to Be the Tenderest Lover, comes from Live Oak with Moss. Note that it begins with a reference to having to hide behind an impassive exterior. Surely a reference to the fear of disclosure, a kind of closet. So Whitman did struggle. For all of his bravado in Song of Myself, for all of his sexual bragging and whatnot, he did struggle with this. But he admits in this poem his impassioned love is more important to him, at least in this point of his life, than anything else in the world. Yet there's something restless about this love. The poet's greatest dread is not being recognized and his love not being reciprocated. And finally, note how the poem concludes with two lovers wandering hand in hand, far away from anyone else, apart from other men. Every gay man of a certain age knows this need to escape the madding crowd and the constrictions of society. So that note rang true. That would be one of the 12 poems that are included in the new book, so to speak. Okay, here again is my used copy of Leaves of Grass, kind of like a Bible for those people who read a lot of it and teach from it. And just to remind you that that work contains a lot. We've been reading mostly from Song of Myself, which is about a 50-page work. Well, of course, with Whitman, he is so connected to everything else, it stops being a poem about myself. It's a poem about the whole world around him. But anyway, Leaves of Grass contains that. It contains the drum tap poem from the Civil War, Memories of President Lincoln. I sang the Body Electric. And then there's a section called Calamus. Do you know what the Calamus plant is? It's also known as a sweet flag. Well, it's common enough. It's an overtly phallic plant, a solid cylindrical, I'm quoting here, solid cylindrical spadix emerging from its leaves, obviously a symbol for manly love, to use Whitman's reference. So originally his manly love poems were in Calamus, including several of the ones in this new book, but not all together. This is Whitman at age 35. It's an engraving, 1854. It was included in his first copy of Leaves of Grass, 1855, self-published. And this is an engraving. It's not easy to do this at that time. 1855 printing presented many more challenges. There was very little photography in printing. But note how unusual it is for an author's introduction to society. Most authors in that time knew photography was expensive, and they didn't waste the opportunity. They were dressed to the nines. You look at that one we have of Edgar Allan Poe, and you look at Nathaniel Hawthorne, you look at all of them, they are. They look serious writers. But Whitman didn't want that image. This is the image he wants. He is downright jaunty, one critic said. Very, very casual. No necktie for him. With one hand on his hip and the other in his pocket, with his hat cocked and shirt open, Whitman identified as one of the roughs men that he favored and wrote about so often in his many poems. Now, this is a new book. It's a little expensive, but it's a very nice coffee table book. 12 poems that mostly are available in some other work of Whitman. You would think, well, that's stretching it for a book. But this is Whitman's 200th anniversary, and an artist, a famous children's artist, Brian Selznick, illustrated it. Got some interesting illustrations. I'm still deciding whether I like them all or not. It has some good essays in it. So if you're a Whitman fan, it's new, and you can pick it up and leave it on your coffee table. I do recommend it if you like nice books. This is one of the illustrations of, guess what? A live oak tree, which is another great symbol for Whitman, the live oak. In fact, it was a reference to another symbol that involved a live oak. If you took a twig of a live oak with a few leaves on it and encircled it with moss, such as Spanish moss, that too was a manly love symbol. And that explains the title. Whitman knew two cities well, I guess, Manhattan, New York City, he knew that well. But also he spent some time in New Orleans. And in New Orleans, I think in 1849, 1850, he got to know that city quite well. He probably saw the beautiful live oak trees. I think there's one in Audubon Park that's been there for hundreds of years. And, of course, that far down, you see moss with it, too. I don't see much moss up here, do you, the live oaks? But anyway, one critic said, Whitman admired the muscular anthropomorphism of the thick limbs conveying a primitive power and sensuality. An example of art from the book, this is the New York City of 1857. That was after the publication of Leaves of Grass. Whitman was poor. He was living with his family. There were many problems. They lived in Brooklyn, way out. But he had time to come to the city and to walk around Brooklyn and other parts. This is a collage, and you can see the fiery orange figure. That's Whitman. And then you see photographs of naked muscle men in the windows of the building. At any rate, in a building like that, in 1857, there was in the cellar a bar called Pfaff's, P-F-A-F-F apostrophe F, Pfaff's Beer Cellar. And it must have looked like the first gay bar because women did not go to saloons back then. That didn't happen until Prohibition when they went to speakeasies. So almost all men. And the men who went to this place is, by the way, still standing at 647 Broadway, just north of Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village. The men who went in this place were an interesting mix. There were a lot of working men, and Whitman loved those. And then there were folks who worked in the theater district. There were journalists, progressive thinkers, kind of a coffee house atmosphere with a lot of free thinking. Some people say it was the first bohemian place. In 1857, and all of this proved irresistible to Walt Whitman, and that's when we think that he became involved with a lot of men, or maybe not a lot, but more than one, probably. Another conception of the live oak. One of the poems is, I saw in Louisiana a live oak growing. You may have heard of that one. Now, Whitman kept notebooks, of course, as a poet, and he was a poet that collected details everywhere. Among his notes were notes apparently he took of men, I guess when he went out to the bar. And here's a list of some of them. All different types there. That looks very modern, except there's no telephone number, no cell phone. It's interesting that the last person on the list, Peter Dempster, is described as open-faced and gay, although I don't think Whitman meant anything but happy. It's just an irony there because, again, the word gay, in most cases, I don't think had a common reference that we use today. Well, 1857, remember, was just a few years before the Civil War. which of course would change everything for Whitman and most everybody else in the country. Whitman, as I noted, worked as a nurse in the military hospitals, and the casualties of that war were horrific, you probably know, both in scale and in suffering, because the medical technology hadn't kept up with the weaponry. Amputation was common. Lots of suffering. One critic noted that Whitman could not have helped changing perspectives on life as a result of this experience. Seeing so many young men slaughtered and butchered does not lend itself to more poetry about vigorous, manly love. And he didn't write any more of that, for the most part. The truth is, he grew more conservative and cautious as he aged. Though he continued to revise and expand Leaves of Grass, he removed some of the calamus poems. It was as if he knew that the culture wasn't ready for the utopia he envisioned. And I think we would say that he's right. You're talking about 1880, all the way through the rest of his life. And you remember what happened to Oscar Wilde at the turn of the century. But when he was first exploring in 1850s, who knows how this all was portrayed? There was no, people didn't use the vocabulary we used. Who knows? There are some records in his notebooks about struggles with desires and impulses that he doesn't like. But he had other things to think about, as so many other people did. By the way, there's one touching poem, kind of a prose poem, as much of Whitman is, in the Live Oak book. And it envisions a gay community, LGBTQ community, 100 years before. It reads, "I dreamed in a dream of a city where all the men were like brothers. Oh, I saw them tenderly love each other. I often saw them in numbers walking hand in hand. I dreamed that was the city of robust friends." Friendship, friends in Whitman, is a very close same-sex relationship. It's also the word adhesion. That's another code for it. "I dreamed that was the city of robust friends. Nothing was greater there than the quality of manly love. It led the rest. It was seen every hour in the actions of the men of that city and in all their looks and words." But that was in his youth, relative youth. In 1890, responding to questions about the sexuality of his calamus poems, Whitman skirted the issue, saying that he had had 6 children, 2 now dead, and has 1 southern grandchild, a fine boy who writes to him now and then. Having not studied the biography in detail, I just don't know. There's so much we don't know. We can all guess why Whitman was not more forthcoming. Maybe he was being prudent. Increasingly, there would be a price to pay for public homosexuality. And again, I point to Oscar Wilde, who visited, by the way, and there's pictures of him and Whitman. I don't think this ever came up much in the discussion. Well, Whitman had envisioned an ideal society, one that granted equality to all and included a noble place for what we now call the LGBTQ community. But there weren't even any acceptable words at the time, and virtually no scientific understanding of human sexuality. And, of course, Whitman has so much to admire, but remember, he was a man of his time. And you know what he swore in? Phrenology, having your bumps read. He was big on that. War, old age, and society's resistance to change all take their toll, as they did with Whitman. Still, he left a legacy. He did try to envision a way for the underdogs of the world, including gay people, to fit into a just and decent society. And for that, I think he deserves the title an icon, gay icon, an icon in so many other ways as well. Well, that's all I have to say this morning, unless anybody has, I feel like class, anybody has a question. But thank you so much for your interest in Walt Whitman, and I hope all of you have a good week. Eric?